Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70 celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined as always in Zoom conference by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. Tim, since we last spoke, the Mets have taken 3 out of 4, including 2 out of 3 from the very good San Diego Padres, and now the first in a 4-game set with the Cubs that suddenly looks a lot sunnier after a stellar pitching performance from a guy we beat up on last show, David Peterson.
Yeah, I don't think we can yell at them for not being good against teams over 500 now, as because the Phillies are now over 500 and because they beat a couple teams, they are now 13 and 16 against those teams after being, I think, 2 and 12 at one point. So that's how that stat changes. And Peterson, you know, after two really rough starts, kind of answered the bell on Monday night, pitching 6 scoreless. First time in his career he pitched 6 scoreless, and you know it wasn't a dominant performance. He didn't like cruise through. I shouldn't say that. I mean, he had like 3 consecutive 10 pitch innings, but he was in control of the game, and you know, got away with there was like one bad 2-seam fastball early in the game that was hit really hard by Wilson Contreras, but the rest of the game it seemed like he had better command of his fastballs, of his slider, just what we saw a lot from of. It was a lot of what we saw last year from David Peterson on Monday night, and that was a really nice step in the right direction for him and for a rotation that's going, you know, as good as the top three, as good as the other 4 guys have been lately. They're going to need that 5th guy, that 6th guy, probably even a 7th guy to pitch well over the next couple weeks.
Yeah, and like you said, not totally dominant, not a ton of strikeouts, not an overwhelming number of ground balls. I think he got 7 ground balls, which is solid, but not like a good Marcus Stroman ground ball game. But what matters is the results, and for the first time in 3 outings, he got results, and I think makes you feel a little bit better about this back end of the rotation, especially because Joe Lucchese has also been pitching quite a bit better.
Yeah, I mean, Lucchese, I think we really started that conversation. We answered that question about the difference between his ERA and FIP. Ever since then, he's been lights out. You know, he made the mechanical changes to his delivery. He's not going over his head as much in the windup. He's got a simpler motion out of the stretch. Mets think that's eliminated any pitch tipping issues that he had previously. Since then, I think the ERA is about 1.5 over 4 or 5 starts at this point. You know, he hasn't gone super deep into those games. He finished 5 innings last time. 18 hitters, they did not want him to face the Padres order a third time. But, you know, I think he's slowly earning those opportunities moving forward, that you can maybe trust him against a lineup a third time a little bit and see what he can do against it.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if you saw his post-game presser, but he was I would say, refreshingly frank about that. And, you know, you know starting pitchers especially always want to stay in the game. We all remember Johan Santana yelling, "I'm a man," at Terry Collins and whatever else. But, you know, Lucchese, a guy who hasn't necessarily, you know, doesn't have a long major league resume. And he was respectful of Luis Rojas' decisions, but he said, yeah, like I want to pitch deeper into games. And it's an interesting question because, you know, this one loss of the last 4 was one that presented several managerial questions. And I think, you know, these are the type of things, especially bullpen choices, are very easy to look at in hindsight. And a lot of times, you know, managers have more information than we do, for better or worse. And so, you know, we know he was shorthanded. Luis Rojas was shorthanded in Sunday's game. I don't know that we know the extent to which he was shorthanded, but he was certainly going to avoid Lugo and Loop and Edwin Diaz. And yet, Lucchesi was cruising through five innings. He opted to take out Lucchesi after the fifth and go to Jeurys Familia, which worked out fine in the first of his two-inning stint, and swiftly came unraveled in the seventh. To me, leaving, and I dislike leaving Familia in for that seventh inning a lot more than I disliked pulling Lucchesi after five.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about it in the spring, the third time through the order penalty that Lucchesi has suffered from in his career. Coming into the year, you looked at, you know, the OPS against the first time through against him was 738, second time 685, third time 805. Seems like it could be an issue. But then if you look more specifically at, like, the individual batters that he faces three times, so, you know, if he faces 21 guys in a game, the first three hitters, and compare how he does first, second, third, then it's a really stark difference. And that's really the decision you're making as a manager, right? A guy has gone through the lineup twice well. Should we give him a third time? In those instances, Lucchesi, it's a 652 OPS first time, 629 second, 922 third. So in his career, he's had games like Sundays where he's looked really good, and then he's gotten to that third time through the order and struggled. Does that mean you never give him a third time through the order? No, like, you occasionally give him that opportunity. A one-run game against a lineup that's front-loaded the way the Padres lineup is might not be that time. I'm okay with pulling him in that situation. I think if you were really concerned about your bullpen depth or shallowness and availability that day, then maybe you could have considered an opener for that instance so that Lucchesi could go a third time through the second half of the order. I don't know how that would have affected him mentally, though, given that he had several good starts before that, and now you're going back to an opener. That's probably something that would feel a little too cute at the time. So I was okay with that part of it. Familia, the second inning, you know, I was surprised he's only done it once before this season, because he did it a few times last year, but not really in close games. And, you know, the first time he did it this year, he'd gotten two outs the first time around and was going for three more in the second inning and tired in that second inning. I think he got the first two outs and then allowed a couple guys to reach. Did get out of it clean, didn't allow a run, but, you know, I think he threw 37 pitches that time and clearly was feeling it towards the end. Whereas, again, on Sunday, you could see that he just didn't have it as the pitch count got elevated on him. So yeah, I think I would have made the move with him at least one batter quicker, for Pham, which is what Jacob Barnes said. He thought he was getting, you know, thought he was getting ready to face Pham. And then he comes in for Tatis, and gives up the home run. I probably would have gone with someone that is not Barnes, you know, whether it was Drew Smith, or, Trevor May, for that big out, and then figured out what to do in the eighth and ninth innings, if you had to pinch hit for May. That's the biggest point in the game. They held off on him. And, you know, like, it's individual bullpen decisions. Like, I was thinking the other day, like, I should start a Twitter account where I quibble with every bullpen decision a manager makes that I dislike, and it would be the busiest Twitter account in Major right. League Baseball, because it would be, like, three a game for 30 teams.
Yeah, if you and I have done this. I did this multiple times in the past, but basically every single year, if you search any manager's last name and bullpen, you can find evidence of fans of every single team in the major leagues who are convinced that their team's manager is the worst at negotiating his bullpen. And it's just that, you know, the fickle nature of bullpens, again, these, you know, the occasional limitations that sometimes we don't know about. Miguel Castro is, I guess, a little bit banged up. And so, yeah, you could say, like, going to Barnes there, a guy who has really been hit the hardest of anyone in the Mets bullpen in a huge spot. A questionable decision, but not a ton of buttons he had to press. You point out Trevor May, who hadn't pitched in a very long time. Now that's a potential hiccup too. You're not sure you want to bring a guy in for his first time in a week to face Fernando Tatis Jr. with the bases loaded. Plus then what we saw out of May in Monday night's game certainly did not inspire a lot of confidence that he would have gotten out of that situation any better than Barnes did.
Yeah, I mean, he's had struggles with the home run ball as well of late. So it was a bunch of imperfect options, and that's kind of what the Mets and Luis Rojas are going to have over this stretch of so many games in so few days, is that there's going to be games where you don't have several pieces in your bullpen available. You know, hopefully not as many where you're missing basically four of your top five back-end relievers. In Diaz, Castro, Lugo, and Loop. But there's going to be times you're picking between, you're pushing someone into an uncomfortable area, whether it's pushing Lucchesi into a sixth inning and a third time through the order, or pushing Familia to a second inning, or pushing someone like Barnes now designated for assignment, but pushing someone like that into a higher leverage spot than they've been used in the past, and hoping it works out. And it will work out at times, and it won't at others. And I don't think that's necessarily, you know, like that will happen over the course of a 162 game season. And it is okay that that happens occasionally. You just don't want it to be happening all the time. Like, you know, if that same thing plays out and you had Edwin Diaz and Miguel Castro available, that's very different conversation that we're having than with those guys not there.
And that brings up another point, really, which is, and you know, we're harping on one loss in a three-game series against, a very, very good San Diego Padres team, and a team, the Mets, that are now, you know, pretty healthily in first place in their division, despite the Phillies playing well, a team that has about an 85% chance of making the playoffs, according to both FanGraphs and Baseball Prospectus, so, you know, it's important to keep some perspective, but can you put some blame on the front office for giving Rojas a game where he was down four members of his bullpen?
Well, I mean, like, they've got nine relievers. So even if you're down four members of your bullpen, you've still got five. I think the question is, like, how much had they talked about moving on from Barnes? Because, you know, obviously they designated him for assignment a day later. And if you're going into a game, and you know Lucchesi is probably not going to go more than five innings, you're worried about getting, you're thinking you're going to try to get length out of someone in your bullpen, and you want it to be Familia, then you can say, well, why didn't they make the move, you know, Sean Reed Foley for Barnes a day earlier than they ended up doing? Maybe that's a question you have for the front office, that's not Rojas's decision as much. So when you get beat by the ninth guy in your bullpen against, you know, arguably the best hitter in the National League in a big spot, you feel like that's a failure on multiple levels. But again, it's one game. I'm not going to castigate Rojas or the front office too much for that.
I will fire them all. They lost the game. How dare they?
That was one of the comments essentially on my story about that game, was we've got to start talking about Luis Rojas and firing him because of this game.
Literally the day before people were saying he's the preemptive favorite for manager of the year. And then like a half hour after that, it was like, fire this guy. He brought in, he left Familia in for a second inning.
Yeah. I also do not start talking, you know, like I think it's okay to start talking about Cy Young and MVP and Rookie of the Year candidates. I think it's very strange to talk about Manager of the Year candidates in June because so much of it is based off of like what the writers' expectations for a team were.
All the award is manager of the team that most exceeded expectations. Like, does it have anything to do with your managerial ability? Maybe, right? But like, mostly it's just like, hey, this team performed a whole lot better than we expected, so like, it must be the manager.
Yeah, like I remember one time voting for it in the American League, and Paul Molitor won because he had taken a team that had lost 100 games the year before and they'd won 85 and made the playoffs, and I did not place him first on my ballot because I thought that team should not have lost 100 games the year before under Paul Molitor, and that they were actually a much better team than that the year before. And, you know, like, there were other good candidates. I ended up voting for some. I was the only person who put first on the ballot a guy who was later suspended for a year for cheating in AJ Hinch. But, you know, Molitor got fired again a year after that. So it's just, it's a weird award. I don't think we're like well positioned to actually know who the best manager in baseball is or in a league is. And so I just feel uncomfortable like saying, oh, you know, the Mets have had some injuries. Let's give it to Luis Rojas on June 15th. And the same, you know, I wouldn't say like Gabe Kapler's Giants are doing way better than I expected. Kevin Gausman is great. I think that's Gabe Kapler's doing. Let's put him first.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Switching gears briefly, and I did not prepare you for this, but just before the show, I was one thing I like to do with my spare time is just like sort of open up Jacob deGrom's baseball reference page and stare at it blankly and appreciate it. And I was doing that as I often do on Monday mornings. And I started looking at that, some of the categories, the stat categories there are. Now, Baseball Reference this weekend added Negro League stats, which are now, you know, officially recognized as Major League stats. So Negro League stats have been added to the leaderboards, and this changes some of our historical stats. A guy by the name of Eugene Bremmer, who was actually in his career, I believe, played more outfield than he did pitch, at age 20, pitching for the Cincinnati Tigers, finished a year with a 0.71 ERA, a 6.33 ERA plus, and he allowed no home runs. He only pitched 50 and two-thirds innings. It was a much shorter season. Those are now the benchmarks for ERA and ERA plus. And Jacob deGrom, if this season were to continue as it has, which is unlikely because he's been otherworldly even by his own standards, he would become the new all-time leader in ERA for a season, the new all-time leader for ERA plus in a season, the new all-time leader for fielding independent pitching in a season, the new all-time leader for walks and hits per innings pitched in a season, the new all-time leader in strikeouts per nine among qualifiers for the season, and the new all-time leader in strikeouts per walk for a single season.
Yeah, that would be impressive. Well, I'm trying to think, like, is there anything he would not be the all-time lead? Like, what is he lagging behind in?
Well, he's not going to catch, like, the 18, like, the old Hoss Radborn, or, like, I think there was a guy named Will White from the 1880s who would throw, like, 670 innings a season. I'd say innings pitched, he is unlikely to match up with the old guys.
Yeah, he's not going to get to 40 wins, we don't think, this year.
40 wins, it seems unlikely, you know, unless they start like a major change of view. Like if they're like, what if we just bring in DeGrom for the fifth every single day so he can get to 50 wins or whatever.
It is not, you know, they've won his last five starts and he's got 4 wins in that stretch. So they are actually taking advantage of him pitching in a way that they didn't in 2018 and 2019 when he won the Cy Young, and they weren't at the start of the season. But it would be funny is not the right word because this is a Mets podcast, but it would be ironic if he does finish with an ERA that starts with a 0 and the Mets go like 15 and 16 in his starts.
Yeah, that would be, yeah, I would say, like, it would be not surprising is the answer. Like, for, it would be surprising for literally anyone else in the world, but for, with DeGrom, you'd be like, yeah, that actually sounds about right.
Yeah, I mean, the Brewers were kind of doing that with Corbin Burns for a while. I think they have improved on that, where I looked like 2 weeks ago to see what pitchers did have like the worst, their teams had the worst record when they started, and Corbin Burns was like third in the National League, third worst. But they have started winning for him and everyone else of late.
Yeah, the Brewers pitching staff has been just incredible. And it brings up an interesting point, which I have a bone to pick with something you tweeted, which is a stupid road to go down, because if you wanted to bring up things I've tweeted, we could be here for a very long time. But you asserted that DeGrom would be perhaps the Mets' only All-Star. Now, we're a month out from the All-Star game, and a lot can change between now and then, as you know and I know. But I have to feel like Marcus Stroman and Ty Walker have earned All-Star nods this season.
You know, the following tweet said, of course, Stroman, Walker, and Edwin Diaz would warrant serious
consideration. No one sees the No one sees that. No one sees that.
Yeah, I mean, like, DeGrom is the only one you're sure of, right? Like if he doesn't pitch between now and the All-Star game, he still makes the All-Star team. And, you know, like you were saying, I mean, in 2018 at this point in time, I was thinking that Brandon Nimmo was a shoe-in for the All-Star team, and then he got hit by a pitch, he slumped, and he didn't make it. In 2019, I was looking at the first baseman in the National League, and I was like, I don't think Pete Alonso cracks this group. And of course, he did. So, you know, you take June All-Star projections with a grain of salt, because they're only two-thirds of the way there. You know, DeGrom's going to make it. Walker and Stroman, I think they're in position to be part of that conversation. The issue is you've got a lot of really good starting pitchers in the National League right now. You know, like, as good as they've been, you know, Walker's ERA is fifth in the NL as we record this on Tuesday morning. Stroman's is 2.32. That's 10th in the National League, which feels like it should be better than that. You go by WAR, or at least Fangraphs WAR, and they're a little bit lower. Walker is 13th in the NL. Stroman's 23rd, because FIP is probably not the best measure of what he's capable of as a sinker baller. And you also get starting pitchers. I'm trying to think through some of the less competitive teams in the National League, who their all-stars would be. If you have to worry about, like, JT Brubaker being the Pirates all-star, probably Adam Frazier, but I'm not positive on that. You know, Max Scherzer will be there for the Nats. Trevor Rogers should be there for Miami. The Reds have some good hitters. The Diamondbacks could be Ketel Marte, I guess. I don't think it's anyone from their pitching staff. And then Colorado, you know, maybe it's Austin Gomber or Herman Marquez, who are having like decent Rockies-ish seasons. Ryan McMahon's been pretty good for them. He might make it as an infielder, but you've got that to deal with as well. So I think if you're talking about 12 pitchers and you're thinking like 8 or 9 starters, those get Walker and Stroman are already like at the cut line as we speak.
Right.
You know, we'll see how they do over the next month. Like, there's no reason to have concern about them like completely falling off a cliff, but you know, if you're asking like take an over under on their performance to this point with a combined 2.21 ERA between the two of them, and what they'll be over the next month, like, I think it's just logical to take the over, because you just don't think they'll be quite this good for the rest of the season. I think this is as good as they've been together in a long time. So, you know, same with DeGrom. Like, if you're asking over under a 0.56 ERA to this point, I'll probably take the over, but, you know, not sure.
Ye of little faith.
You know, I'll definitely take the over on Kevin Gausman's 1.43. That will be my over.
That's a safer play on a Mets podcast. But I guess the point about All-Stars sort of emphasizes something about these Mets, which we've talked about quite a bit, but how very much the pitching has been carrying this team, which is a successful team, 33-25 and sitting in first place. And like I said, the, you know, overwhelming favorite to make the postseason in the National League East, depending on which version of wins above replacement you use. Their best, well, actually by both Baseball Reference and Fangraphs, their top offensive player has been Francisco Lindor, a guy who has been overwhelmingly, until recently, a disappointment. It's just his defense has been valuable enough, and he's played, which puts him at odds with just about everyone else in the regular lineup. He's played every day, and so that has been enough to make him the most valuable guy on the team. Second most on Baseball Reference is Pete Alonso, who now, you know, despite earlier slumps, if you look at the big picture and if you compare it to the league, which is important with Alonso because it's not going to be that 2019 numbers because no one's putting up 2019 numbers, but he has a healthy 130 OPS plus. I don't think you can complain about that. But, you know, obviously does not bring the defensive value of an elite shortstop. And by Fangraphs WAR, tied with Francisco Lindor at the top of the Mets list is Jonathan Villar, a guy I don't think we would have likely talked about as a potential like position player MVP for this team as of early April.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at the Fangraphs WAR now, and you know, you've got Lindor and Villar are tied at 0.9. They're not even at a full win above replacement yet. Third, you have Brandon Nimmo, who's missed the last month. Fourth is Alonso. Fifth is JD Davis. He's missed the last month plus. Sixth is Billy McKinney. He's played 14 games. Seventh is the backup catcher, Tomas Nito. Eighth is the backup center fielder, Kevin Pillar. Ninth is Jacob DeGrom. So it's a really wacky list, and it speaks to the way that their position player group has just not been stable over the course of the season. It is like Lindor just has 40 more plate appearances than just about anyone else. 30 more than Smith. Smith is next at 31 plate appearances behind him. So that's why he's built that up. He's also, you know, an excellent defender. So even in disappointing offensive season, he's still been their most valuable position player. So I don't think we're going to see any Mets position players on the All-Star team. But it does, you know, VR's placement there raises some you can ask, like, should he be playing more regularly even after everyone is back? You know, should he be sharing some time with Davis at third? But Davis himself has played really well, has hit a lot. You know, JD Davis is chasing 400. He's got a 390 average in the middle of June. It is only in 48 plate appearances, but, you know, he's been really an important part of that lineup the little bit that he's been in there, the same way that, like, McKinney has. They've kind of been similarly productive in the same span of time. And, you know, you can start to project out when all of these guys get back. There's a much higher offensive ceiling for this team than we've seen. Like, they're in first place because of all that their pitching has done. And that pitching is likely to regress, like we just talked about, a little bit. You know, that's still very good pitchers at the top that you expect to be good, if not, like, absurdly good. But the offense should be able to balance that out, theoretically, that those guys come back. And the offense starts scoring more than four runs on a more consistent basis. But, you know, we still have to see that happen. We've got good news. You know, Jeff McNeil could be back this weekend. Michael Conforto and Nimmo could be going out on rehab assignments by this weekend. So, you know, you could imagine a scenario where by the time the Phillies come to Citi Field, that last weekend of June that the Mets have, McNeil, Conforto, and Nimmo all back in their lineup, and really Davis is the only one they're missing from their usual starting nine.
If that happens, do you think that it's as simple as everyone goes back to the spots they were in? McNeil plays second base every day, Conforto right field every day, Nimmo center field until perhaps late in the game when you maybe slide him over for Pillar, or and leave VR at third base where he's played very well, and like you said, where JD Davis is not imminently returning, or do they get a little more creative with it?
Yeah, it's interesting because of the timing of it with McNeil coming back first, because he's the one who can bounce around a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, do you, with Conforto and Nimmo due back relatively soon after, do you even bother with having him go to the outfield at all? Because, he's a guy who can play left and right. Do you put him in right field on some days because you prefer to have Guillorme in the lineup than, like, Pillar in center? You know, you can bump McKinney into center field a little bit. I don't think you want to do that too consistently. I think if you feel good about Conforto or Nimmo coming back within a week, you probably don't mess around with the outfield for McNeil, considering he's coming back from a hamstring injury. And at least the team has said in the past that playing the outfield kind of stresses his legs a little bit more than playing the infield because of all the running. So I probably wouldn't do that because it's such a short time difference for the guys to come back. But if, you know, if there's any kind of setback or change in timing and you're talking, okay, it's 2 to 3 weeks until those guys come back, then maybe you start to think about McNeil out there. But, you know, I think in general, it's probably just bringing him back to play second. And then you have VR and Guillorme can get some time at third base as well. And you probably start giving Lindor a day off more frequently than they have. I think they've only given him the one so far. So you can spot him at short a little bit more easily than you have so far.
Well, and I think you also you slot McNeil at second base because you don't want to. Yeah, I mean, it would feel very wrong to take Billy McKinney out of the lineup at this point.
Yeah, I mean, like he's the guy you're trying to keep in there more so than Guillorme or Pilar, even with the way McKinney's hitting of late. You just kind of ride that hot bat, and then you know. Again, Billy McKinney's probably not going to deliver 1,000 OPS the entire season. But you know, while he's performing this way, you stick with it, I think, until he cools off.
I think that's right. And I think, I mean, am I wrong in saying that? I think that if, you know, and this is the type of thing, these things always work themselves out. You know, we talk about like a roster crunch, a playing time crunch. I hate to say it, you know, someone's going to get hurt. Someone else is going to get hurt. That's how baseball goes. There's never been a team whose problem is too many good players and not enough playing time to go around. You figure that out. But if this team returns to full health, has Billy McKinney earned himself an outfield role moving forward? Like, do you bring back Almora? I don't know. You know, do you bring back Almora if he's healthy over McKinney at this point?
Well, I think, you know, he's earned the possibility of a bench spot, right? Because when everyone's healthy, I think you're still playing Smith, Nimmo, and Conforto in your outfield on a regular basis. But when you look at, okay, who do you want coming off your bench? Pilar is there. And then if your fifth outfielder, I think you can make the McKinney over Almora case because of how he's played so far, that he gives you, you know, Almora and Pilar are kind of similar in the sense that, you know, they're both right-handed hitters. They can both play center field. They're both positive defenders, more so than offensive players. McKinney's a little bit different than that. That's a problem. Pretty nice bat to have off the bench late in games when you want a pinch hitter. You know, Almora has options and McKinney doesn't. So it's easier to hang on to both of them in that situation. You know, Almora is another guy who could be back by this weekend. And I think Luis Rojas has talked about him as if, you know, he's a shoo-in to be activated to the major league roster. Of course, that's before you have Nimmo and Conforto back. So, you know, he can get, they bring him back. And then maybe it's Mason Williams who gets sent down or in his case designated for assignment because he does not have options.
And he's also played well, to be fair. I mean, it's a very limited amount of time, but he's played well.
Right. He's got an OPS plus over 100 as well in a very short, you know, 29 plate appearances and has played pretty good defense. So, you know, you've got some decisions there. And it's interesting to me because you think ahead a month from now and the trade deadline. And while this team, like the position players have been the weakness of this team all season, like their offense has not been what you expected to be. But because of the return you have of all these players, because of the depth you've built up, because of guys like McKinney and VR stepping up, even as pitching has been the team's strength, that seems like the area that you'd want to buttress the most going forward in the trade deadline, and like finding another starter, because there aren't reinforcements there coming in the same way, at least not until later in the season in Carrasco and Syndergaard. Maybe Carrasco is back sometime in July, but
You can't count on it.
You don't feel quite as confident about rolling out your starting five the rest of the season as you might with your starting nine.
Well, we have a question about buttressing the rotation for the distant future. from Zach on Twitter. He wants to know, he says, for the next podcast, I'd be interested in hearing you guys talk about the potential for a Marcus Stroman extension, the likelihood, the cost, the length, and any insights Tim may have as to possible ongoing discussions. So start with that last part. Do you have any insight as to possible ongoing discussions?
I have more insight into like flying buttress design and medieval cathedrals or something.
Big
like
Gothic
that.
Guy, yeah. I'm curious why Zach doesn't want to know if I have any insight as to possible ongoing discussions. I am, some will recall, the person who very tentatively broke the Scott Hairston signing of 2010 or 2011 or whatever year that happened. But yeah, I also have no insight. I guess the insight that I have is that if you look at the free agent starters for this offseason, there's Clayton Kershaw, and I can't imagine Clayton Kershaw is really going to be on the open market for anyone. Like, the only two scenarios I could see for Kershaw are like he returns to the Dodgers. It seems like he'll be a Dodger for life. And then there's like this slim chance he wants to go home and pitch in Dallas and play for the Rangers. But like, I just can't see a big bidding war for Clayton Kershaw this offseason. And so Stroman looks like kind of the best starting pitcher on the market, and a guy who made a really, really good call in taking that qualifying offer and like almost as a pillow contract for free agency. And so it's hard to think that at this point in the season, Stroman has said, you know, I mean, it seems like Stroman's really happy. He talks about how much he loves his team. He loves his teammates. I know I, for one, absolutely just love watching this guy play baseball. I would love to see the Mets extend him. It doesn't seem like a good business move for Stroman and his team to sign an extension now when he pitches anything like this well in the second half of the season, he is looking at a payday in free agency. He's only 30, so he's got, you know, he's on the long side. He'll be on the long side of 30 in free agency, but not, it's not like he's 34, 35. He's got some good years ahead of him. Now, you know, you look at the back of the baseball card, and it's more good years. He's had some inconsistency in his past. He's had some injuries in his past, but he has been in recent seasons largely healthy. He opted out last year, but the rough 2018 looks like the anomaly of his last four seasons. The others being healthy and effective, and so to me, Stroman looks like a guy who could be looking at nine figures in free agency.
Yeah, I mean, you've got the free agent class. You've got the older cohort with Kershaw and Scherzer, and don't forget Justin Verlander coming off Tommy John surgery.
Oh, right.
Be a free agent as well. And then well, I think
and
got,
Scherzer's hurt now too, right?
Right. I don't know if they put him on the injured list. He might pitch against the Mets this weekend, okay. Depending on how that works out. And then you've got some younger guys who are still older than Stroman who have shorter track records. That like Gausman is going to be a free agent coming off what presumably will be a very good season for him the way it's gone so far. You know, John Gray, Anthony Sclafani's having a nice year in San Francisco. Carlos Rodon, who's having a really good season for the White Sox and is younger than Stroman. He'd be, I think, the only guy on that list under 30, along with Noah Syndergaard. So, you know, Syndergaard's issues this year that he's probably only going to have a handful of starts before he hits free agency.
Now Syndergaard almost feels like he's in Stroman's situation where he, if they offer him, he would be sort of wise to take that qualifying offer.
He can think about the qualifying offer. It really depends on how he does over us. If he looks really good for six starts and then is part of your postseason rotation and has another couple good starts there, that could be enough for a team to bet on him. I was thinking a couple weeks ago, like, you know, when Zach Wheeler signed his 5-year, $118 million deal with the Phillies, at the time he had a 100 career ERA plus, you know, that was a team betting on recent results and stuff. I wondered, like, how much money is Zach Wheeler's success in Philadelphia going to make some other guys like Noah Syndergaard, like Kevin Gausman, like Rodon, like guys who have shorter track records of success but strong recent results and who have always had the stuff to be good. I wonder how that will affect the free agent market. And that's something that Stroman, because of the way he pitches, because he's a sinker baller and doesn't get as many strikeouts, he doesn't tantalize a front office right. The way some of these other guys do.
And because he's 5'6", which is unfair, right? But it's true, right? Like we have this, Zach Wheeler looks like a pitcher, right? He's 6'4" and lean and he throws 100. And like, that's a guy you feel like you can look and see an ace. And I think it's still hard for teams. Like there are these built-in biases, a lot of them, you know, across the board in baseball, but it's, you know, one of them certainly is against short right-handed starting pitchers. And so I think it's like it's a mental leap for some front office guys, even in 2021, to like go for a long-term deal to a guy who just like doesn't look the part.
It's 5'7", you know, he earned... When we're under 6 feet, we like every inch to be counted.
David Wright was listed at 6 feet, and I am 5'10", and like David Wright was a guy I looked eye to eye at.
Yeah, there are covering the Red Sox. They had a bunch of guys who were like my height, and I was like, oh, I can't use the height excuse for the reason why I did not succeed in baseball the way I can in basketball.
Well, and Pedroia is tiny. Pedroia is whatever he's listed at is generous. So Altuve, a lot of these, their baseball heights are questionable.
Pedroia, Betts, Benintendi, Bradley. I think I was as tall as all of them, if not taller. With Stroman, yeah, like if. For him, it does not make sense to engage on an extension at the current moment because it's not going to be for the same amount that he would get in free agency. You know, I think the Mets are probably more liable to be involved in a Stroman free agent conversation this winter because of what's happened not only with his success but with Syndergaard and the way things have gone with him this year. It'll be interesting whether, you know, if Syndergaard takes a qualifying offer, that would happen relatively early in the offseason, the same way it did with Stroman last year. And if that happens, then you say, okay, you've got DeGrom, Walker, Syndergaard, Carrasco, and Peterson coming back for next season. Do you want, is Stroman the guy you want to spend money on? Or do you want to try to upgrade somewhere else? Do you want to save that money for Michael Conforto offensively? Mm. If Syndergaard doesn't take the qualifying offer, then I think, you know, if you're trying to choose between Stroman and Syndergaard, you might be more apt to go, you know, whereas before the season, I would have said this is a team that would probably pick Syndergaard because of its history with him, because he's a year younger. Now I wonder if that's switched more to they'd be more interested in having Stroman long term than Syndergaard because of the better track record of health and recent results, obviously. But I think it's a really interesting dynamic to have. It's really tough for me to figure out how, you know, I haven't done the deep dive on wins above replacement and stuff and try to project what they would make in the offseason. Like you said, 9 figures for Stroman.
Especially with the way contracts have been going, I feel like that was maybe hyperbolic on my part. Like, I think that if he, again, I think that with a different build, he might be like, if he was looked like Gerrit Cole, like it might be different, but I don't know, maybe 9 figures is aggressive, but like, again, you know, he's a starting pitcher, he's been healthy and he's really good,
right? I mean, he's been he did make the All-Star team in 2019, so he's been an All-Star, you know, if he makes the All-Star team this year, that's an All-Star twice the last two seasons he's pitched. You know, build and stuff aside, the biases against them, if you just look at the numbers, I think when I did it a few years ago, prior to the 2020 season, I was looking at kind of like the Homer Bailey contract, which is a terrible contract. You don't want to like be put in the same sentence as that because the contract worked out so poorly. But obviously Stroman and Bailey are very different pitchers. Mm-hmm. But that was 6 for 105. And I thought like Stroman would be like a 5 for 105 guy at that stage. I'd have to go back and look at it again.
But the whole market has changed since that, right? Like, right. Yeah. Like that's just Homer Bailey would not get 6 and 105 now.
But I think it is probably, you know, none of us thought Wheeler was going to get 9 figures. Again, market's mm-hmm. changed since then. Both of those free agencies, Stroman and Syndergaard, I think will be fascinating and big stories for the Mets, because I don't think there's much of a chance that they'll bring back both. I think there is a chance they bring back one.
Well, as a fan, it's tough. I love Syndergaard, but watching Stroman, and I always liked Stroman with the Blue Jays. Like he's a very interesting and engaging guy. Obviously, he's sort of a different sort of dude with the height and the way he wears it as a chip on his shoulder. But man, watching this guy pitch has just been awesome. And I think watching him talk post game too. He had a comment that I loved when he was talking about DeGrom and Walker and the whole staff. And he said, you know, we all feed off the goat, and made me think of Greek Easter a little bit. And that I found enjoyable. And also just like how good of an athlete he is and what a solid, like what a excellent fielder he is. He looks good with the bat. Like he strikes me. It's a weird comp, but he almost reminds me of like Mark Burley, this guy who is just like, this guy's just really good at baseball and happens to be a pitcher. And I love guys like that. Dallas Keuchel is another guy who kind of reminds me like that. Like, and they're all ground ball pitchers. And I think that's a ground ball pitchers who are excellent fielders, which is like always a fun thing because it means you're getting some opportunities as a pitcher that you might not if you were more fly ball prone. But just for me, a delight to watch.
It's just so refreshing to hear a Georgetown alum speak so highly of a Duke alum.
Yeah, I mean, but even that is like even that is cool, right? Like this guy, he blew out his knee in 2015, and he could have gone, you know, he could have put his head between his put his tail between his legs and been sad all year, but he went back and got his degree. Like that's cool. That's something I really respect. Like he didn't have to, right? Like he was bound to make tons of money playing baseball, and instead became a Duke alum.
Yeah, so it's I think he's so much fun to watch because he is different from so many other pitchers, and because he, you know, we talk about wanting to see more emotion, more excitement in baseball, and he shows that every fifth day, and his defensive prowess as a pitcher is something else. I don't think I've ever covered a pitcher who is as good defensively as he is, and that is something you don't see very often. It's not something that's like emphasized when we discuss the sport is how good a pitcher can be with his glove. So that is.
But if you're a ground ball guy and you're a plus defender, like it makes a real difference over the course of a year.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably an out every two games he pitches that he gets that almost any other pitcher doesn't. You know, there was the fun one in Colorado is the one that sticks out. I think he also had one against the Rockies at home that was a remarkable play. So, you know, I think I'd have to check, actually, if he's leading the Mets pitchers in defensive runs saved, because Ty Walker had a few, not just in his last start, but also because he holds runners really well. So Walker's still their leader in DRS as a pitcher because of how well he's done holding runners, I believe. But the Mets have gotten really solid defensive work from several different pitchers, from Stroman, from DeGrom, from Walker. All those guys are good fielders on top of really, really excellent pitchers.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the in conclusion on Stroman is I don't think it makes sense for him to sign an extension. I doubt the Mets. I'm sure the Mets realize it doesn't make sense for him to sign an extension. He and I wouldn't blame him at all for testing free agency. But as a fan, man, I really hope they bring this guy back.
Yeah, and that would be, you know, you can imagine that keeps, if they keep either of those guys, really, that keeps most of their rotation intact moving forward, and you've got kind of your five, you know, depending on whether it's Syndergaard on a one-year thing or Stroman on a longer-term deal, you've got those five together for a little bit of time going into 2022.
If you, like Zach, have a question for the Metrospective podcast, you can tweet it at us. I'm at OG Ted Berg. Tim is at Tim Britton. You can email it to me at asktedberg@gmail.com. Please, if you enjoy the show, rate us, review us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts and everywhere else you find your podcasts. Tim, as always, it has been a pleasure.
Adios, Ted.
Peace.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.